This is Martin Pinder, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 21st of June 2011. Martin Pinder.
My name's Martin James Pinder, born in Hastings on the 29th of January 1946.
So that makes you how many years old now?
65.
You don't feel it, do you?
Pardon?
You don't feel it, do you?
No, not at all.
Tell me a bit about your background. What sort of schooling did you have, Martin?
Most of my schooling was in private schools, but I went to a boarding school when I was 7 years old at King's Langley, and then my parents moved to North Wales, and I went to a prep school in Prestatyn, St Chad's School. And when I was 13, I got two scholarships, one to go to a school, Kent College, Canterbury, and one to go to Ranagh School in Scotland, Perthshire, which was run by an ex-assistant headmaster from Gordonstoun on the similar lines. So there was a lot of outward-bound activities, rock climbing, hill walking, sailing, all sorts of things. So that's really when I developed an interest in the great outdoors.
When you say you were offered a scholarship, does that suggest that you were academically bright?
Possibly not. certainly the school, whilst it was excellent for outward-bound activities, wasn't an academic success. I was taking A-levels. I only got six O-levels. And after two terms of that, I thought, really, I've outgrown the school. So I left when I was 17 and went to Hereford Technical College. Oh, I got a job at a local hotel doing all kinds of things, stoking the boiler, cleaning the toilets, polishing the shoes in the morning, going and collecting the newspapers and delivering them. And my parents said, well, if you're going to do this, you better go and get trained in it. So I did 2 years at Hereford College, catering college, and my final year at Birmingham College of Food, and took a course in hotel management. And in between that, I'd got a job for the summer in a hotel in France. And when I finished, I got a job in Switzerland, first of all as a waiter and then head waiter and then as a chef in a hotel in Zurich.
Was it an intended career for yourself, this, the hotelier business, or was it just something you fell into?
It's something really I fell into. I really wanted to go to art college, and I came up to Shrewsbury and they asked me to bring examples of my work, like a portfolio, which I didn't have, so I hurriedly put together some things. And the interviewer, probably the principal of the art college, said I had no talent whatsoever. And even if I did, there were no jobs in it. So I was declined. That's why I fell back on catering.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was self-employed sales agent. Very successful and very hard working. Used to sell fancy goods to little gift shops, but his main money came from trade shows where he'd sell to big department stores and get great big orders. And because he was self-employed, he'd get 10, 15% of any order. Mm. So he wasn't well off, but comfortably off.
And what's your first recollection of knowing that the place called the Antarctic existed? What was your first brush with it?
Well, it was when the lock in Rannoch froze over. I think it was 1963. And it was about 10 miles long and 2-3 miles wide. And the bottom third of it froze over. And there was about a foot of ice. And the edge of it would go up and down. And we could skate on it and open your duffel coat and go whizzing along. And that just talked to me. Obviously, I'd heard of Scott and Shackleton and read about it. And then I found Jeremy Bailey, who I'd known at my first boarding school, because his mum was a friend of my mum. And at weekends, they'd come and take myself and my brother, and we'd go, we watched the coronation at their house on a tiny little television, 1957. And Jeremy Bailey went down the Antarctic. Unfortunately, he lost his life in a crevasse. I think it was 1966. But I saw lots of his black and white photos. And it just interested me.
You knew Jeremy personally, did you?
Yes, I did, yes.
You were in the same year at school?
No, he wasn't at the school. We just knew him.
Right.
Through my mother, and she was close friends with his mother.
What are your memories of Jeremy?
Of course, I was only about 7 or 8, so all I remember, we used to love going to his house, because up in the attic, they had this enormous model train set that went round and went round the door, so once you were in, you couldn't open the door, otherwise the track would move out and the trains would all crash. But we used to have great fun there. And his brother, I think he's doing something with the Memorial Trust at the moment. Yeah.
Did Jeremy talk to you about the Antarctic? Do you remember that particularly? Did he have penguins?
We didn't have contact with him apart from when I was very,
very small.
Very young. Yes, very small.
And the fact that he had died in that Muskeg crevasse accident, did that not in any way put you off wanting to go to the Antarctic? Because you were in the unusual position amongst potential FIDs of actually knowing somebody who didn't come back.
No, it didn't. In actual fact, I wanted to find out what happened, because I know his mother, Dulcie, didn't believe the Bass version of the tragic accident.
Well, can you expand on that?
Well, apparently they were off course. They should have had dog team leading to probe for any crevasses. And the Muskeg went down, and Jeremy was in the cab, and it was the dog team came back, and a chap went down on a rope, but he was so horrifically injured, even if he could have got him out, he wouldn't have survived. But the person, and I do not know his name, had to go back to base knowing that he had to leave somebody who wasn't actually dead, so it was a horrific thing for him.
His name was Ross.
Was it?
Hmm.
Yeah.
So his mother, that's a story his mother heard?
Yes.
From other FIDs?
Yes, because the actual report that should have been still on base was not there. I'm not suggesting it was a cover-up or anything. I think it was just to save people's personal feelings.
Mm. Yeah. There's more than one version of the story?
Yes, yeah.
Perhaps it's best not to speculate now, but I'll come back to that with you later on if you like.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were not deterred by
by
Jeremy's death?
No. Because I wasn't, as a cook, I shouldn't have been out in the field anyhow, unless the base had sent me out because they didn't like my cooking.
So tell me about the process of getting this job in the Antarctic.
I'd worked myself up, and I was assistant manager, actually, at the St. Vincent Rocks Hotel in Bristol, which is just up by the Clifton Suspension Bridge, opposite what used to be called the... Oh, I think it's called the Avon Gorge Hotel now, but it used to be called the Grand Spa. And I'd gone as far as I could. I was assistant manager, but I was only 22. And there's no way I could have become a manager, even in a public house, because the company, most of them then, wanted married couples, because you get 2 for the price of 1, or 1.5 for the price of 1. And they offered me a job as a banqueting manager at a very posh hotel in Oxford. And same time, I think I saw in the Daily Telegraph an advert for cooks wanted for British Antarctic Survey. And I thought, oh, that would be wonderful. And I went to the interview, was successful. And it was only when I had to go and get on the ship in Southampton, set off, I thought, oh my goodness, what have I done now? 2 years, 2.5 years. But I'm very glad I did it, because it was a life-changing experience.
What do you remember of the interview for the job? Appreciating it's 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. 40 years ago.
I think I was interviewed by Bill Sloman and Eric Salmon. They asked me what my likes and dislikes, and obviously asked me about the various schools I'd been to.
Was it rigid? Was it rigorous?
No, it wasn't really. It was very relaxed. It was just like having a conversation.
Were you surprised to get the job?
I was, and I... No, not really, because I had quite a wealth of experience. I suppose in a way I was, because I hadn't... Although I'd done... worked as chef and second chef, etc., etc., I hadn't spent my whole career as a cook or a chef. It was more in management, accounts and reception. So I had a general experience of hotel work, but I hadn't spent my whole career to date working as a chef. So in that way, I suppose I was surprised.
Well, perhaps there's more to the job than just simply cooking. You've got to manage resources extremely efficiently, haven't you?
Yes, and plan menus and keep the troops happy.
And your Outward Bound experience, did that come in useful?
Well, it certainly did, because I could ski, not fantastically, but I could get about on skis and go downhill. And I knew a bit about rock climbing and snow and ice climbing. I knew how to use ropes and ice axes and crampons. So I think, well, certainly when I got there, it did.
And when you stepped on board the Pearl of Dan in December 68, did you have any... You mentioned... Well, did you have any misgivings, or were you just kind of overwhelmed by the prospect before you, but keen to go still?
Well, once I'd stepped aboard and once the ship had sailed, I thought, well, this is it. I can't suddenly say, no, I've changed my mind.
Did that cross your mind?
Not at all, at all. But, of course, you don't know anybody.
You've not been to Cambridge, have you? Not been to the conference?
No, I didn't go to Cambridge. I wasn't asked to go, I don't know. Perhaps I was late. I think I possibly was. Wasn't there a cook who had to be... had to go back?
I'm not sure, but the conference will normally be in September.
No, I... Because I'd packed my job in at the hotel in July, I think. So, no, I don't know why I missed it. I think that was one of the reasons. I think there was a cook from Adelaide who had to be airlifted out, and so they were short of a cook and said, right, you're in.
So you were a last-minute recruit?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, that's not clear. Don't worry about that. Don't worry. And did you know where you were going? Because they sent you to Sydney, didn't they?
Yes. I did know where I was going.
Did you know where it was?
I did, yes. It's at South Orkneys, which I thought was nice because of the North Orkneys, the Orkneys, and then you've got the South Orkneys. Yes, I did quite a bit of research before I got there.
And when you got there, what was it like?
It was fabulous, absolutely fabulous.
How do you mean?
It was just, you looked out over the from the base and you just, Coronation Island and all the snow-covered peaks and the glaciers and the elephant seals. On the first time I went for a walk, I heard this sort of... and I thought someone had brought a motorbike down to the base. And it was these elephant seals on the making this noise. And the penguins, you'd see them... You go round quite high up a side of a hill and there'd be a penguin halfway up the hill, just squawking. We didn't see any whales there. We did on the way down. But, and, of course, we had giant petrels. So it was the wildlife I just thought was absolutely fabulous. And the colour of the sea. And the, no, it was a beautiful place.
Was wildlife an interest you had anyway from your outdoor work?
It must have been. And I went down with a Kodak Instamatic camera, which everybody laughed at. But each of the bases has their own darkroom and quite a good supply of printing equipment. But after a short while, I got myself better camera equipment because you could get it duty-free. And I used to go out and had an Olympus Pen FT, which is half frame, so you get 72 on one roll of film. And I'd use it almost like a diary. I'd go out and take... You get a half-frame mentality because you take two or three of the same subject. And then I'd do contact prints of the whole... And then do postcard size of the whole lot. And if any were, I thought, were good enough, then I'd blow up to... You could, even with that size, you could blow them up to 8x10 with not a too much grain.
Mm. This was a hobby that you developed before you went south?
Developed, yes.
Sorry.
No, I'd never...
I'm not intended.
I'd never used a camera
before. Oh, right, so you learned on base?
Yeah, absolutely.
And were you being taught by somebody?
Oh, yes, there were people who'd go and show you how to unload the... take the film and put it on the, into the developing tank and show you how to print things. It was excellent, and I think that was one of the best things about there, because... You could, if you were interested, you could learn from the scientists and help them with their work. And lots of them wanted to come and make bread. Because, of course, I had a day off a week and they'd take in turns cooking. And some of them just enjoyed it so much. So we learnt off each other. It was very good.
What were the catering facilities like at Signy in the late 60s, 69?
Well, it was an Arga, coal-fired Arga stove, which you had to keep in, and that was the night metman's duty to do, because if it went out, it was a devil to fire up. We'd have to open up the flue and put newspaper in the flue to get an updraft to get it to go again. But it very rarely went out. You just had to make sure it didn't run out of fuel. Obviously, we didn't have a dishwasher. We had an electric kettle.
The Arga was it, was it really?
Yes, yeah.
And no fridge, I guess?
No fridge. You didn't really need one because you could put your stuff outside. No, that's interesting. Mind you, when... Because we... I think, no, they did have a fridge for the sea samples of various different...
A science fridge rather than a food
yes,
fridge.
Yes, yeah, but we'd keep any frozen food in that.
What about things like grilling? Did he have a grill that you could...
No, we didn't have a grill.
Toaster?
Toaster we had, yes. Yeah.
So it was fairly basic.
Very basic.
Compared to the hotels in Bristol you'd worked at before.
Yes. Yeah.
And what about the handover period? You were taking over from Alan... Spencer, nicknamed
yes.
Spanner.
Yeah.
Did he have much of a handover period, or was that not necessary?
It was about a week. Basically, he just showed me round, showed me where all the stores were, and that was it. He was off.
Had you had any say in what stores were to be delivered to Sydney that winter?
Not for the... winter I was there, but I did for the next year.
You ordered for the following?
Yes, and I put a notice up on the board asking for suggestions of what people thought we should get in, and then when it arrived, it bore little resemblance to what I'd indented for, so I had to get in touch with Bass HQ, and they actually ramified it.
So what sort of things Were you asking for the second season? In other words, what sort of things were you frustrated that you didn't have?
I think it was different types of jam. More of the luxury type of foods, but then Fids always want that. And I thought we had we were very well supplied.
Really?
Yes, very well.
And was it traditional English fare, or was a continental food or overseas food involved?
No, it was traditional English.
No pasta?
Oh, yes, we had pasta. Sorry, but I consider that English.
These days, yeah. And rice. So.
Yes, yeah.
So you were able to cook Italian?
Yeah, Chinese.
Indian?
Yeah. Yeah, curries. Yeah, so, yeah.
A lot of it was kind of pre-prepared, canned stuff, wasn't it, I imagine?
We had the bacon was tinned and sausages were tinned. The one complaint was we had copious supplies of dehydrated vegetables, like green beans in a great big tin, about 4 kilogram tin, and dried egg. And I did swap loads of cases of that with Jerry Cutland of the Bisco for more luxury items. And after the Bisco left, these cases of dried egg and dried beans kept floating up onto the beach because either he or his crew had chucked them overboard because they didn't like it.
So he was able to see you right, so to speak.
Yeah, but perhaps he was being nice and giving us stuff that we really wanted, because we had about 2.5 tons of this dried egg, and which is, well, quite a lot, really.
Did you have cause to use his book, Fit for a Fid?
I've still got one of the original A4 things, and yes, I did, with, as I found, we did eat shag or cormorants, but they weren't very pleasant. Penguins were okay, but you could only eat the breast meat off the penguin. And at Sydney, we had Notothenia neglecta, ice fish, which Eric Twelves used to catch. Not very many, but enough to feed us at the meal. And they were delicious, absolutely delicious.
So were you out shooting wildlife yourself, seal and...?
No, we didn't. We didn't shoot to eat. If somebody like Jim Conroy, I think, shot some GPs to dissect them and find out what they had in their stomachs and things, so then you could eat that. But at Sydney, we didn't. At Halley, we did shoot seals, but again, for scientific purposes, not for food. And I did cook them, but there's only certain bits of each animal that you could eat.
So what was how good was Fit for a Fid?
Very concise, very good indeed. I mean, you could, if you were down there today, you could use it as a, except it would, you wouldn't be allowed to anymore. You couldn't go out and cosh a penguin over the head and bring it back and eat it. That would go against all the principles of conservation, wouldn't it?
No, but 40 years ago you could.
Yes.
So you were using Fit for a Fid a fair bit, were you?
No, because I used my own recipes, but if, for example, if it was penguin, seal or shag, then yes, I would use that, because obviously I'd never... You don't get those on an English menu, do you? Although nowadays I see a lot of pubs are put on things like alligator steak, kangaroo steak and buffalo. Don't it seems to be the end thing?
What was your... So the recipes you took south with you, I suppose every good chef would take his favourite recipes in a folder. What was your signature dish, if you had such a thing in those days?
I don't work on recipes.
You don't?
It just comes out of my head. It's right. A bit like mixing concrete. I'm not suggesting it comes out like concrete. But,
it's a limited parallel.
I can see something and then I can adapt it with what the ingredients that I've got to make it come out the same.
Well, let me rephrase the question. Were there meals you made which were in demand to be repeated?
I think my pears in curry cream sauce was an absolute favourite.
Now, they're so legendary, I've heard about this.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about it.
Well, basically, it's just whipped cream with a little bit of caster sugar and tiny bit of curry powder. And then you can use melon, but obviously we didn't have melon down there, but we had tinned pears. And then you just coat the pears with this curry cream sauce. And it sounds revolting, but you can either have it as a starter or as a dessert. And it's really refreshing. It's got to be served, obviously, chilled, which is no problem.
And what about a main course that you were asked to do more than once?
I suppose Spanish omelette, where you've got sort of dehydrated onions. You do it in a big tray. And onions, bacon, potato. But obviously, they do all these things are tinned. Garlic puree. And the other one, I think, because I used to make about 12 pounds of bread every day. And
in the Argo?
Yes.
It's difficult to control?
No. I'd use a third of it to do, four loaves. Another third, I'd do a pizza. And in the dough, I'd put grated cheese, tomato puree, lots of things. So the dough wasn't just a basic bread dough. It was actually flavoured. And then put the topping on it. And the other third, I'd put sugar in it and cinnamon and make doughnuts and deep fry those. So it was multi-fueled. And I think the pizza went down very well.
Did you ever use penguin eggs?
Penguin eggs? Yeah, at Sydney, we had loads of them, and we keep them in a big, long box in flour, and they would last for a year. And they were excellent for baking and omelettes, but no good for frying, like a fried egg, because the albumen, the white, wouldn't set. It would just remain horrible, runny and clear. So it was a bit off-putting. You wouldn't want to eat that like that. So you couldn't use them as fried eggs. But for baking and omelettes, they were fine. And we'd only take, because lots of them would lay three eggs. Well, obviously, you'd only take one egg, because they couldn't rear three chicks anyhow. So it wasn't cruel.
Tell me a bit about the other things you did when you weren't actually chained to your arga.
Well, each day somebody would be on gash hand, a scientist or some other member of the base team. So they had to stay there, and they'd be responsible for washing up, clearing the base up. So I'd do breakfast, and most days, if the weather was fine, I'd get the lunch prepared, and I'd ask the gash hand to dish it up, and then I'd be out either skiing, photographing, just walking around the island.
So you had a fair bit of spare time then, as such?
Oh, and obviously I come back. No, because I get the gash hand to do smoko. I'd be back for lunch. Then I'd pop out again in the afternoon. So, I was out an awful lot. And then cooked the evening meal when I came back. Many times, the one time I remember, I came back to base. And the divers, because sometimes it's warmer in the water than it is out, but then they've got to get back to base quickly and get changed. And I come back in a hurry, because I was always late, to do the evening meal. And they'd all be lined up against the arga, warming their behinds. And I got fed up with saying, oh, excuse me. So I lifted a lid up on one of the hot plates on the Arga and poured a load of cayenne pepper on it and then just put it down. And I went and sat in the lounge, and a couple of minutes later, we had to evacuate the base, open all the windows and the door. But they didn't do it again.
They got the message, didn't
they? Yes.
Yeah. I've also got a note here to ask you about a green bread.
Oh, I did that once as well, because if you make the loaves and you go away somewhere, no one can resist fresh bread. And instead of cutting it properly, they just tear it to bits. So I'd come back and there'd be a few little breadcrumbs left on the floor. And I said, oh, what are we doing with this? So I put green vegetable dye in the dough, and that slowed the consumption down.
They thought it was mouldy, didn't
they? Tasted the same, but it didn't look very pleasant.
Tell me a bit more about, sorry, we're drifting about a bit, it doesn't matter, but when you did have time to get out and into the field, mm-hmm. between your meal times, what were your favourite occupations? What was your favourite place to go? Or
well, there were
favourite
two,
thing to see?
There were two huts where you could go and stay for, well, as long as you liked. The one was,
you mean overnight?
Yes, the one was at Gourlay and the other was at Foker. And at Gourlay you had obviously loads of penguin, big penguin colony, but also fur seals. So, I mean, I used to go out sometimes just to enjoy skiing and going up on the proper mountains and skiing back down. But other times I'd just go out taking photographs. But I did spend 3 nights at Gourlay and 3 nights at Foker. Because they used to, you know, the people on base would say, you know, if you want to go and take your pictures, just, you know, go for a couple of nights.
Were you taking cine film by this time as well?
I did, yes. I took a lot of cine film. Yeah. I had a battery-operated one in the first year at Sydney. And I remember I filmed from my bunk room Coronation Island and put the lens of the cine camera up against one lens of the binoculars and filmed it, traversed it slowly. When I eventually, after a year, got this film back, I thought, this isn't mine. Looked like somebody flying through the Alps. But we went up Wave Peak, and Edwin Mickleborough, who actually made a film and the BBC was put it on, he lugged all his 16mm camera equipment up to the top. I say lugged, it was in an aluminium case, but it was quite bulky and heavy, and it just wouldn't work. But this little one worked fine. So I got some wonderful footage of seals, Weddell seals. The one where I'm on the sea ice and there's open water and the seal looks up at me and then just with a flick of its tail glides underneath the sea ice. Fantastic. And another one I've got was a shag, blue-eyed shag at the sea, and it got this fish in its mouth. It looked almost as big as itself, and threw it up in the air, and so it changed so it was head down, and then just gulped it down. Horrible to think, isn't it? You swallow them live, and then...
and you were climbing sandy fields as well?
Yes, we went with Dave Rinning, Elliot Wright and John Edwards. And we went over to Coronation Island.
You're not the first fit to make that mistake.
On the sea ice. We were man-hauling, because Sydney in those days, well, they hadn't for a long time had dog teams, and we couldn't take the skidoo. Although I think possibly we had taken a skidoo and a sledge full of our food boxes prior, And we spent, I think it possibly was 4 or 5 weeks going across the Pomona Plateau to the Sandy Field. And we climbed the 4 different peaks. It wasn't a technically difficult climb, although it was about 1 foot deep of rime frost in parts, so very difficult to belay or to get to any points where you could anchor yourself to. And then coming back, that was the only dangerous bit, crossing over the glacier. We were a little bit off route because we came back a different way. And Elliot and John were ahead, and Dave and I were behind. And the sledge broke a crevasse bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, what on earth was that? Because there was a big boom, as though somebody had fired a cannon at us, and a great plume of snow came up in the air. And the sledge had just broken, and it was just leaning over this, and you could, I took a photo looking down, and it was seemed to be bottomless, just black. And I mean, we could have dropped down that, and we wouldn't have got out. And I'd unhitched myself from the sledge, because I thought if the sledge goes down, it's going to pull me down with it. But we extracted it and went round, and we were much more careful after that.
Well, I was going to say, did your memories of what happened to Jeremy Bailey affect the way you influenced the way you did your field work?
I think, well, if you're driving in a motorised vehicle, you can't have somebody walking in front with what we used to call a bog chisel, which is like an aluminium pole with a sharp end on it, probing every... and that's possibly why the dog teams would... But then, if you're in a hurry, you sometimes disregard what should be or would be basic safety rules.
In any case, a dog team might happily not, cross a snow bridge and a rather heavier muskeg
go through.
Yeah.
When I'd been running with a dog team, and we were running along a crevasse instead of across it, and the skis were going... Oh dear. But again, I've had a dog team that's... We didn't exactly know where we were, and I was shouting a mirror to go right. Is it? I can't remember. Out left, I think. And they wouldn't go the way that I wanted, but they suddenly swerved up there and found an old marker post, which a previous team had left out there. So, and you put a number on them, so we knew exactly where we were then.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say the dogs had sort of saved us. Yeah.
Was there a time when you feared for your life whilst you were in the Antarctic?
I think that crevasse was possibly the one. The one. I mean, there was another one at Halley Bay where I stupidly went out onto the sea ice to take some photos of some crab-eater seals, and it... previous years, 2 people had been blown out to sea and never got back on similar thing.
Mm.
But I kept an eye on the gap, so I knew I could jump on.
Well, let's talk about Harry, because you did your first season at Signy in 69, and then for 1970, did you choose to go to Halley, or were they...
No, they just wanted to go down the peninsula. I wanted to go to either Adelaide or Argentine Island. But they said, no, but you can go to Halley if you want.
And you had a choice?
Yeah.
Of going to Halley or going home?
No, or remaining at Sydney.
So you chose to go to Halley?
Yes.
Just for the experience?
Just for the experience, basically.
How was it? Because it's very different from Sydney, isn't it?
It was like... when we arrived, now I know now that all the base members from Halley do it deliberately. They put on their stinkiest seal blubber covered anoraks and trousers, and it was like we were being invaded by Neotandle men. Because of course we were all in lounge suits, and they came on and they want the bosun so they can get all their beer and whiskey and stuff. And it was completely different from Sydney. The the bass. I mean, when we had sort of parties and things, and everyone would get dressed up and behave properly, but it just appeared to me to be much rowdier and rougher. But I suppose there were twice the number of Fids there than there were at Sydney. And I think the thing that struck me was the complete lack. There was no scenery to speak of. It was just flat, apart from the edge of the shelf, which was quite dramatic in places. And no wildlife to speak of. Very rare that you saw even a bird. So I missed that, and I missed the scenery of South Orkney's. But apart from that, when I did go out on expeditions, it was quite very dramatic going up onto the main Antarctic continent.
So tell me about some of the trips you did, because you had, there were two cooks at Halley.
Yes.
So therefore you must have had a bit more spare time.
We did a week on and a week off in the winter, and then a month on and a month off in the summer. But obviously, if you wanted to go on a trip that was 6 weeks, then fair enough.
But one person, one cook, could feed the whole base?
Yes, especially in the summer, because there were so many people away on field trips, so there weren't a full complement of 26.
Where did you go on your field trips?
I went onto the lower ice shelf with a chap called Malcolm Guyot to do levelling, and we went with a skidoo, and shortly after we got back from doing all this levelling, the whole bit of that ice shelf floated away, so all the work was a complete waste of time. I went with Mark Valance and Doc Leith, and I can't remember his name, he was the operated the thing to track the weather balloons. He was seconded from the RAF, Bill somebody. And we went up to retrace the right line that Graham Wright had put in, because the other Bob Pye crossing was so heavily crevassed it was considered too dangerous to take the vehicles up there. So Graham Wright and we went to retrace this. And we were away, I suppose, 3 weeks, possibly. And that was excellent fun.
That was onto the continent itself?
Yes,
Why was it fun? What was special about it?
Well, it was brilliant weather all the time. So it was, and I took loads of cine film. By that time, I had a wind-up camera with a zoom lens and everything. And I just thought it was magic. And we were very lucky with the weather. We weren't snowed in at all.
Well, what were you doing on these trips? Were you actually the cook for the trip, or were you just...
What was your role on these trips? Oh, I wasn't taken as a cook then. We'd take it in turns to do the...
So you're just going as a GA, were you?
Yes, basically. And on that one, Doc Leith was taking blood samples from us every day.
Do you know why?
I know I don't. Perhaps it was a vampire.
You also went to visit the Emperor Penguins.
Oh, yes, I did. That
with
was
your camera.
Yeah, that was with Doc Leith again and Bob Wells. And it was about minus 40, so Ron Gill couldn't get any of the vehicles started. So we manhauled down there and spent the first night in a three-man tent. And the next day, Ron had managed to get the vehicle started, and he pulled down a caboose. It's like a caravan on sledge. So we stayed in there. And the one night, I was on the top bunk, because you wake up in the morning, even though you pulled your hood tight round there, all your eyebrows would be frosted and your moustache and your beard. And I tied this up tight, and I'd rolled off the top bunk in the middle of the night. And neither Bob nor Ian Leith, they just fell about laughing because they said I was squirming around like a bionic worm on the floor. Because I panicked. I thought we'd thought that the whole thing had gone down a crevasse. I couldn't understand it. I'd fallen off the top bunk. Oh, dear.
So you have to tie that from the inside, effectively.
Yes, yeah.
So getting out again might be tricky.
Well, especially in the dark and when you've fallen from the table. And now the emperor penguins, we built an enclosure because Dr. Leith wanted to test the core temperature of both the parent bird and the chick. And we had a tent on the sea ice where the emperor penguin colony was. But you could only work for... because you had to take your gloves off to fiddle around with this wire to erect the mesh round the cage. And you could only do that for about, first time, 20 minutes, and you'd have to go inside a tent to get your hands back. And the next time it was slower, and it was cold, it really was.
When you say you were testing the core temperature of the penguins, was this anal thermometers you were using?
Yes, yeah. But unfortunately, we found that if once human had touched the penguin, a parent would discard it.
The chick?
Yeah, the chick. So we adopted two of them because we brought them back to base. They slept in Ian's sleeping bag, I think. Brought them back to base and hand-reared them and used to take them out on trips on a sledge down to the sea. But again, they wouldn't go back. They didn't know what to do. It's horrible. And the dogs, I think, killed both of them. Although we put them in, sunk the cage right deep, the dogs still managed to dig right down. And, oh, dear. So really, it demonstrates that you shouldn't interfere with wildlife.
How did you raise them? And what were you feeding them on?
Tin sardines, mainly. And pilchards. You know, you grunge it up, sort of, and then use hypodermic. Yeah. And they were funny. Oh, and I did take... I took a lot of cine film, obviously, the emperor penguins. And I also took... I got a Ewer tape recorder, which I've still got, but it's very old now. And took that down, lugged it around, because it worked on batteries and, of course, off mains, and it had a power pack as well. And I recorded the emperor penguins. And, well, I got that through Mick Mickleborough's father, who worked at BBC at Bristol Wildlife Place. And when I came back, Mick was making a record of sounds of the Antarctic whales and icebergs and birds. And he'd heard that I had the recording of the emperor penguin, so he came up and said, could he use that? I said, of course. And I think I got paid about £4.17 and six and free copy of the record. And I mentioned in the front cover. But I've never had any royalties from it, so I don't think it made the top 20.
It wasn't the bestseller.
No.
The two penguin chicks you reared, how far did you get them? Several months old or into the adult plumage?
Not into the adult plumage, but they were about 3 foot high, so pretty nearly, yes. I mean, it wouldn't have been much longer before they would have fledged.
And the plan was to release them back to the...
Well, rookery. Yes, but they'd become humanised, so I don't think even that would have worked.
Mm.
May have done. It's a bit like that film Happy Feet. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't, but I know what you mean. Tell me a bit about the radio ham work you were doing, because you set up radio ham bases both at Halley and at Cygni, I believe.
Not at Cygni.
Not at Cygni,
no.
Okay.
At Cygni, I did a Morse code sort of evening class with Jake Howarth.
How had you learned? Oh, you learned it from him?
Yes, right. Yes. Okay. Well, it was a few of us, and I found that it's easy to transmit.
And hard to receive.
But
about the radio handwork.
Well, yeah, you needed 10 words a minute, receiving and transmitting, to get your amateur licence, which was issued from the Falklands. And when it went down to Halley, there was ionospherist, and I only know him as Graunch. Can't remember his name now. anyhow, because they were doing the beat, they had to send up things into the ionosphere and then receive, bounce them back. So they had a good receiver there, which you could pick up the world service. And then he said, why don't we get the transmitter out of the old base? So we trogged off down there with a skidoo and a sledge, put an A-frame up with a handy hauler on it. No, we didn't. We used a skidoo with the pulley system. Crawled down through this, it was about 40 feet, I think, went down on a Dexian ladder and crawled through ice-covered little tunnels to get to the radio shack.
Was this on a GY hut or the or Halley 1?
Halley 1.
Right.
And the ice crystals in there were absolutely fantastic. I took loads of black and white photos of them. And then we dragged this thing along, which is quite, it was only hauling it up, we realised how heavy it was. We used a skidoo, and it actually buckled the A-frame that we'd erected with it. But luckily, we just got it to the top. Took it back to the beastie hut, hauled it down the shaft into there, and Graunch then converted it from being AM to go out on single sideband. And I used to spend hours there. It was just you go, you do CQ, and so anyone. But everybody wants to talk, make a contact with somebody in the Antarctic.
This is all voice work or more
voice work? Yes, yeah. And I got through to King of Zane at one time.
Of Jordan?
He didn't speak. He changed signal strength, QSL. And I got through to somebody in Japan, and I couldn't help remembering Tony Hancock's radio ham. What is the weather like there? It is not raining here also. And in those days, you weren't allowed to pass. Like, if I'd have got in touch with a radio ham in England, he couldn't put me through to my mum and dad, but he could pass messages on. And I did. It's only 2 weeks in the year when you could, because of the ionosphere and the bounce or something. It's only about 2 weeks in the year when you could get through to UK. And I, just before Christmas, I got through to somebody in Cwmbran. And I said, oh, would you ring my dad up and wish him happy Christmas? Or ring my parents up. So he did that. And the next time I got hold of him, he said, your father said, what the bloody hell's he doing in Cwmbran? I thought he was in the Antarctic. Oh, gosh. But I established lots of contacts in South America. And when I came out, I spent some time in South America. I'd go and visit these people, and they'd treat you like royalty. It was absolutely amazing.
What was the therapeutic benefit of being a radio ham?
We're just chatting to people on the outside. And it was interesting learning about other people's equipment, and it just becomes like a network, like a Friends Reunited or something.
Does it help keep you sane?
I didn't have any problem with that. I don't think I suffered from midwinter madness, because I was always inventing things to do. And
How were you able to follow world events? Were you aware of what was happening on the rest of the planet?
Not really. I used to get the BBC World Service and just to get the top 20, because we had a magazine at Halley, and I just put that. And the reception was never very good, but you didn't really bother about the news and world events. I mean, in some ways, it's a bit like when you go on holiday. My wife's and I suppose I am a copious soap person, but if you miss Coronation Street or Home and Away for a couple of days, you don't miss it at all. And if you don't get a daily newspaper, you don't miss that at all.
Now, one or two incidents have been asked to ask you about. One was about the Argentinians visiting Halley, which is not a common experience.
Oh, no, they only happened once. We had the Americans visit from the US glacier. And
so how did the Argentinians get there?
They flew in a helicopter from their ship, and they were all dressed up as admirals or vice admirals, and of course we were all in our scruffy old
Did they just turn up, or was it a planned?
No, they'd been in touch on the on the radio, so we knew they were coming. And I found, actually, in the bar, I could understand the Argentinians, although I couldn't really speak fluent Spanish, but I could understand them because it's so much sign language, better than the Americans and their drawl. And when we had an 8-man sledge behind a skidoo, they were all, as I say, all immaculately in uniforms, bright red or bright black.
But you went to get them, did you?
From the helicopter and bring them back to base, because they couldn't land very close to the base because of all the radio masts. And somebody went and tied a skull and crossbones to the bottom of the helicopter. And somebody else hoisted up. Bob Wells had brought his bicycle down with him, which sounds silly, but you could actually cycle because the snow crust was so hard. And somebody hoisted that up the radio mast. So when they took off, I got loads of photos of this skull and crossbone. And I thought when the Falklands War started, I thought perhaps I should send that to the newspaper. But I thought, no, not really. Especially when it got serious, when they sunk the Belgrano.
There's a, ask about the Very Lansing snowmobile. What does he mean by that?
It was an aeroplane that had crashed, but the engine was still intact. And it was put on a bodywork and on obviously on skis with the engine mounted behind. Mm. And it would do 90 miles an hour.
Really?
Yeah. And we all used to, you get six of us behind us, and you get covered in splatters of oil. And Finn, I can't remember his name, Finn it was, who maintained it and did it up again, so it had a resurgence. And he would go in and out of the radio mast, and you'd let the rope down for somebody to ski across, and when you were halfway across, you'd jerk it up so they'd go off. And the idea was to be the last one standing.
So when you say it pulled six of you, you mean it was like a skiing speedboat?
Yes, like similar to what you could go right out on the side and turn sideways and then arc round and pick up a heck of a speed. Yeah, I just wonder none of us ever broke any limbs doing it.
I was going to ask you whether you bothered to tell HQ about this.
No.
So this is your, what happened to the machine in the end?
I don't know. I doubt it. If it would still be there, they probably wouldn't be allowed to use it. No, I don't know.
A scary moment. You mentioned the trip to Coronation Island and the crevasses, but apparently there was an incident with leopard seals coming up.
When Les Graves and I were walking, because after the sea ice had gone out, it leaves almost like a walkway of ice by the sea that you can walk round. Doesn't go all of, sometimes obviously the cliff comes sheer. And we were walking round this, and this leopard seal popped its head out of the water and turned round, and then swam and was trying to climb out to get us. And Les was not actually smack it on the head, but just prodding on the head with his ice axe. But I would dread to think of what might have happened had we fallen in. It's weird that you can swim with the Weddell seals and elephant seals, and they just nosy, they'll come. But leopard seal, although Doug Allen did take some underwater film of a leopard seal, but they're such fearsome looking creatures. I mean, their jaws go right back. They look almost reptilian.
He had a very relaxed attitude towards them, Doug Allen. I saw him on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
But you regard them as threats, do you?
Well, they certainly, unless they were just being inquisitive, but we, in those days, we used to, a place called Gash Cove, where we used to go and tip all the gash. And at one time, I was in the boat, and the leopard seal just put its head up, and it was almost as though it was coming for us. Mm. Whether it's because of the ferocious way they look, or you see them taking a penguin and tossing it about in its jaws and then throwing it in the air, you think, well... Because there was a lady, Fid, who was killed by a leopard seal, wasn't it?
Kirsty Brown.
Yeah. I don't know how or what happened, whether it attacked her or just got a breathing apparatus, I don't know. Yeah. But you say Doug Allen is quite happy with them.
Yeah, he seemed to develop a tactic for working out whether they were going to be aggressive or not.
Oh.
And as you say, he's got some very good footage of underwater footage of leopard seals, so he lived to tell the tale. Just to finish off then, with, if I may, you were lucky enough to see some auroras whilst you were at Halley.
Oh, yes, absolutely fantastic.
Tell me about that and how you felt about it.
Well, I'm not a religious person, but some of the natural beauty there, the sunsets, the sunrises, and especially the aurora, although you know the scientific explanation for it, it still makes you feel as though somebody up there is just waving his hand around to create this fantastic thing. And it really was. I tried and tried to get photographs of it, but none of them came out. No, it really was awe-inspiring, really.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Did you feel the hand of the creator?
Well, that's what I would like to say, although I'm not religious. You could explain the scientific causes of it, but it still felt as though you were down here and somebody up there was painting the sky for you. Yes.
There are two views about having been in the Antarctic for a while. Some people felt it interrupted their career and didn't do them any good at all. Other people felt their career benefited subsequently from the Antarctic experience. And I wonder which camp you fall into. First of all, did you use anything you learned in the Antarctic in your later life? And did the experience, did that line on your CV help?
I certainly learnt so many varied things, obviously photography being one of them. I think it made me an all-round better person, better at getting on with all sorts of people, better at adapting to different situations, and perhaps more self-confident, even garrulous. I certainly think it helped me become college lecturer, and it helped me equate to students. And I think it benefited enormously.
Was it strange going back into... I think you went back into hotel work for a while when you got back, didn't you?
Yes.
Was it strange going back to a fully equipped kitchen and anything?
Well, I was on the managerial side, but first of all, first job I had, because I said to myself, I don't really want to work indoors. It was a summer, and I worked in for Lang's Pipeline. We were putting a pipeline from Milford Haven through to Wolverhampton, and we did all the special crossings of rivers, so it involved blowing things up, and it was great fun. Because you don't dig a trench, you've got great big machines to do all that and crane. But then I drifted back into hotel work as a waiter. No, it wasn't strange really, because it was what I knew best. So, But then it was my first wife who suggested that I go to college and train how to lecture people in hotel management and chefing.
Looking back over your career, Martin, how highly do you rate the Antarctic period?
I know I shouldn't dwell in the past, but I would say it was the highlight of my life, really.
And the fact that highlight took place quite early in your life, does that have any kind of ongoing repercussions? Did you later on feel as though you'd peaked early, or...?
No, because I think I used the experience as a springboard for lots of different things that have happened throughout my life.
That was a good grounding.
Absolutely.
That's marvellous, Martin. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you.